and thanks especially for just for asking me to come, which I think of as a great honour. I'm a literary critic, and I spend my time trying to understand the extremely awkward questions that some writers ask about humans' ethical relationships with non-humans, and that's basically what you're going to see me talking about today. And this isn't from the Postwar Project, this is from a book I'm working on animal ethics and contemporary fiction. I begin with a quotation from George Eliot's Middlemarch, not contemporary. If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heartbeat, and we would die of that roar that lies on the other side of silence. Drawing on these remarkable words, Lauren Berlant argues that we are taught, from the time we are taught anything, to measure the scale of pain and attachment, to feel appropriately compassionate. Compassion and coldness, she continues, are two sides of a bargain that the subjects of modernity have struck with structural inequality. Her point is that ethical feeling for some necessarily comes at the expense of ethical ignorance of others. Animal advocates might well feel a particular wariness towards this notion, given the long history of attacking pro-animal thought as necessarily bourgeois, sentimental, anthropomorphic, or as a kind of moral neo-imperialism. It cannot be easily sidestepped, however, and so I want to confront its implications for animal politics in my paper today. Let me first pick up on the imaginative intensity with which Eliot posits an unconstrained attentiveness of vision and feeling, while also mortally, in fact, precluding it. Principally, Eliot rules out responsible feeling for ordinary human experience on the basis of the more radical impossibility of hearing plant and animal life. But in order to do so, she first has to realise that possibility, the roar of infrahuman experience. Her sentence thus tenuously manages ethical feeling and unfeeling via the discourse of species, and the notion that there is a morally significant difference in kind between the human and the animal, between humans and animals. This strikes me as the crucial ground in which the animal politics of feeling needs currently to be thought through. To do so, I will move a long way from Eliot's 19th century England to the otherworldly contemporary Scotland of Michel Faber's novel Under the Skin. This book, which is an astonishing generic hybrid of neo-Gothic noir, science fiction, and Joseph Conrad-style modernism, is set in the rural and sparsely populated districts of North and Northeast Scotland. The narrative largely focuses on a youngish woman named Isserly, who owes her presence in Scotland to her employment by Vess Industries. This is an agribusiness run from what is presumed to be another planet, although in some ways it's a dystopian allegory of a completely modernised post-industrial capitalist world. The environment there has depleted physical resources, and that society is socially and topographically stratified into at least two groups. The elite, who live in comparative luxury above ground, and those forced to live by toil in what's called the new estates, manufacturing the environmental resources that sustain the elite above. Isserly is perhaps the quintessential subject of modernity, as Berlant would put it. She escapes the living death of such structural inequality the only way such subjects can. She works for the capitalist enterprise Vess has set up in Scotland to provide the exceptional delicacy of meat, termed vodison, culled from earthly humans, known by Isserly and her kind disparagingly as vodsels. The term human is reserved in Isserly's language for what is perceived as her race of people. Having undergone extensive and painful reconstructive surgery to her four-legged body so that she can appear inconspicuous on Earth, Isserly drives up and down the A9 picking up protein-rich male hitchhikers. She vampirically stings these vodsels with drug needles hidden in the passenger seat of her car, rendering them unconscious, and delivers them to a processing plant run underground at a disused farm. The whole process travesties the ethical relationship of hospitality, picking up this these hitchhikers, into the darkest parodic allegory of human agricultural development. Hunting merges into intensive farming, natural life is accommodated and then destroyed. Evisceli's job means that she works as the anthropocentric human par excellence in this allegory, then it's a position that the novel will eventually downsize out of existence. And that's basically the purpose of the paper, is to work out why the novel is trying to teach her not to be anthropocentric, basically. As the novel proceeds, the plant is visited by Amwis Vess, the politically radical heir apparent to the Vess Corporation. At a crucial moment, he meets Isserly in the farm's kitchen. At precisely the point that Isserly tastes some vodzel flesh, Amwis says from the doorway behind her, "You just don't know what you're doing. The meat that you're eating is the body of a creature that lived and breathed just like you and me." Isserly responds, icily, "Mr. Vess, I doubt there's much similarity between the way you and I live and breathe, let alone between me and my breakfast." It's here that Amwis offers the text's eponymous ethical axiom, "We're all the same under the skin." The basis of Amwis's ethics here, not unlike lots of analytics, is the egalitarian assertion of a community across species that's founded on the basis of life and breathing. Uniting materiality and ethics, Amwis aims to uncover a fundamental and crucially internal truth, which, at the level of ethical recognition, nevertheless requires his revelatory gesture to bring it past Isserly's ignorance and into moral visibility. The basis of Isserly's rejection of this idea is an intransigent insistence on material status, referring to his, quote, "filthy rich idealists need to deny social reality." When his attempt to convince Isserly away from the meat via a general principle of moral enlightenment is stymied, Amwis proceeds to invite Isserly on a quintessential gothic journey to accompany him down below, down where the vodzels are, so then they're underground in these holding pens. When she resists, the narrative portrayal of her reasoning is especially telling, and this is where the feeling is going to start to come in. She almost choked on her reply, perhaps because of a tiny thread of meat lodged in her throat. "Because I'm so scared of the depths," she was thinking, "because I don't want to be buried alive again. Because I have work to get on with," she said. This offers a privileged insight into a crucial truth of Isserly's character and into her methods of self-deception. It suggests that Amwis's enlightening gesture cannot quickly dispense with the hierarchical differences of status, the deep emotional and psychological effects these have, and how such effects might occasion or shape moral action. For Amwis, the ethical move to witness what has been forced beneath ground is a straightforwardly moral gesture. For Isserly, the very thought of such a moral excavation is deeply frightening and traumatic. This is a trauma she's already found her own way to repress through full investment in the value of her work for Vess Industries. The bourgeois bargain by which Isserly escapes social stratification on her home planet by getting the job to come to Earth and hunt vodzels. So the way she escapes that social stratification downwards on her home planet by achieving upward mobility through work eventually withers away. And this proves crucial to the text's animal politics. And a key stage of this is the novel's pivotal central chapter, which portrays the journey of descent that began at Isserly's encounter with Amwis in the hellish kitchen, which I want to offer an extended reading of today. Isserly takes him to the underground cages that hold captured vodzels at three stages of meat finishing. Recently captured new arrivals that have been castrated and had their tongues severed and cauterized. Monthlings, filthy, entirely bald, fattened, ready for slaughter, and stupefied by a combination of drugs and sensory deprivation, and transitionals, who mark the intermediary stage in the process. In the first half of the chapter, Isserly struggles to defend this violent treatment of vodzels against Amwis's persistent moral questioning, through which he bears sympathetic witness to their subjection, affliction, and appeal to his ethical responsibility. The question of feeling, the question of feeling is crucial to the politics of species here because it challenges the ideal of liberal humanitarian reform epitomised by Amless, in which sympathy extends straightforwardly outwards to, for example, non-human others if it's not hampered by ignorance or prejudice. That with respect to pain or violence, human ethical agents must be led to cultivate moral feelings about the physical feelings of non-human ethical patients. That's a sort of normal liberal ethical pattern. In this arrangement, if you just replace the ignorance and the prejudice with knowledge and justice, you can just put an end to the violence. Countering this, the chapter tests out in Isserly and Amless opposing attitudes to the ethics of compassionate feeling in a world that's necessarily hierarchically stratified. To whom can we show and to whom do we owe feelings of sympathy and why? For whom should compassion be prioritised, if it can be prioritised, and where is it absolutely demanded? Which principles and what feelings determine the requirement for and which delimit merciful behaviour? So some feelings teach you not to be merciful. Such questions point to the idea that rather than the emotion of pity being straightforwardly extended from the compassionate to the needy, there's actually a two-way relation between currents of feeling and the notions of community that allow the compassionate even to recognise the needy as such. Under the Skin acknowledges the moral challenge of recognising the blurred causality between the formation of community, to which the notion of species, I want to suggest, plays a crucial delimiting role, and both the practices of violence that draw on and sustain that community, such as meat production, and any ethical positions that aim to stop such violence. The very possibility of moral feeling, that is to say, is determined by questions of species community. These are developed in the chapter through an argument between the characters about species being, about what kind of species they are, how you know what a species is, and indeed human exceptionalism, which focuses on the question of language capacity, much like Francois talked at Desco. This works through a proposition that is structurally foundational to anthropocentric human exceptionalism in modernity. One facet of cognition, language, absolutely determines species difference. This renders morally inconsequential any elements of ontological similarity that unite different beings and appear under a dual rubric of feeling, shared kinds of sentience, for example, sensitivity to pain, and affective responsiveness, such as flows of emotional empathy and sympathy that are unstemmed by considerations of species. Key to all of this is a profound reflection on the concept of mercy, which is central to both the chapters and the novel's Politics of Species. Mercy is an ambivalent nodal point of sensibility and legality, compassion and authority, subjection and agency, accountability and imperiousness, weakness and strength. Its particular relevance here is that this ambivalence speaks to the power relations inevitably implicit in feelings of compassionate pity, sympathy or empathy. This is all introduced at the beginning of the chapter as Isserly leads Amless into the dungeon-like atmosphere of the holding pens. Ugh, she groaned squeamishly. To be so far inside the earth was a nightmare come true. A nightmare, yes, said Amless Vess. Isserly looked at him, scared and in need of comfort. But he meant the livestock, of course, not the claustrophobia. She could tell from the infuriating grimace of pity on his face. Typical man, so obsessed with his own idealism, he was incapable of feeling empathy for a human being suffering right under his nose. She's the human being. Isserly reacts to the subterranean environment by emitting a groan, a non-lexical vocalisation. As an apparently unconscious expression of both emotion and sensation that coincides with the affect of squeamishness, This foregrounds the fact that her experience of horror, the nightmarish claustrophobia that is the result of her experience in those estates on her home planet, is not simply psychological but embodied. As vocal animals, humans, like Isserly, like the ones in this room, do of course express themselves through such guttural sounds. Yet this quite contravenes the logic of species that allows Isserly to animalise Vodsols by referring to their utterances elsewhere in the chapter as grunting and snuffling, a corollary of referring to them as livestock in this passage. Of course, for Isserly, the species' perspective is entirely assumed, it's just how it is, and so her furious response to Amelis' facial expression draws out the full moral nightmare of this scene. His compassionate response to these livestock animals might well be impossible for her, blocked as it is by speciesism, but it has its own blind spots too. In this zero-sum game, his pity for Vodsols precludes pity for Isserly. Because of this, she finds his act of compassion to be primarily an act of self-centeredness, in this case, a typical kind of masculine self-aggrandizement. Following Lee Edelman, we might note Isserly's refusal of compassion's necessary excess in the way that it confuses our own emotions with another's. Even if her attitude is a good example of a concomitant fact, Edelman notes that, quote, every hardening of the heart against compassion's knock presents itself as hard-headed reason resisting false compassion. And yet, it is all too easy, I think, to recognise Isserly's picture of a self-servingly idealist masculinity here. The chapter is thus set up to address this crucial dilemma. Does Isserly's realism about species difference, her belief that humans are absolutely to be prioritised over Vodsol animals, miss something fundamental by denying her own animality, rooted as it is in bodily feeling? And if so, how does this weigh against the fact that her human suffering is ignored in Amelis' grimace of pity, motivated as it is by the possibly sentimental idealism that projects subjectivity and with it recognition in cross-species community onto the Vodsols? As he and Isserly view the newly arrived and tongueless Vodsols in the pens, Amelis is astonished to find one of them drawing in the dirt. The moment is worth quoting at length. No one told me they had a language, marvelled Amelis, too impressed, it seemed, to be angry. My father always describes them as vegetables on legs. Describes what you classify as a language, I guess, said Isserly dismissively. The Vodsol had slumped behind his handiwork, head bowed in submission, eyes wet and gleaming. Isserly, but what does it mean, persisted Amelis. Isserly considered the message, which was M-E-R-C-Y. It was a word she'd rarely encountered in her reading and never on television. For an instant, she racked her brains for a translation and then realised that by sheer chance, the word was untranslatable into her own tongue. It was a concept that just didn't exist. Isserly stalled, mouth hidden behind one hand, as if finding the stench increasingly hard to take. Though her face was impassive, her mind was racing. How to discourage Amelis from making an unwarranted fuss. The two characters react very differently. Isserly's dismissive equivocation is literally hypocrisy in action. It acts mainly to preserve the appeal to language possession as a moral shibboleth, rather than genuinely arguing that Vodsols can't use a symbolic sign system. As such, her attitude is at least in part motivated by Amelis. Its defensiveness is part of an interpersonal power play in which she is asserting her sense of self-worth that she perceives to be under threat by his compassion for Vodsols. Amelis, on the other hand, apparently marvels at this evidence of Vodsols having a language, but we should note that with the use of the phrase it seemed in the reporting clause, so it's says, I've lost the quote now. Where's it gone?
It's second line on the screen.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. So, too impressed, it seemed to be angry. That his attitude has been exaggerated, perhaps even imagined by Isserly in her apparently guilty assumption that he would be angry, angered by this discovery. Amos doesn't focus on the marvel of the Vaudsells having a language, but on how this evidence refutes his father's extremely disparaging speciesism about them. Rather than interpreting the scrawled word mercy as evidence in a positive statement about ontology and moral value, he's fascinated by meaning, the capacity of the sign to act as a communication, that is to say, an utterance that addresses a possible response from the person who looks at it. The relationship between language, the possibility of communication, literature, and the ethics of compassionate feeling is complex here. First, despite what she says to Amlis, Isserly's private thoughts about the written word mercy acknowledge that it is semantic. But knowing the word to mean something, she reflects that the concept is untranslatable. Absolute sociolinguistic difference between humans and Vaudsells implied by this idea of untranslatability has the power to turn signs into non-signs, to turn sense into nonsense. And Isserly's eventual solecistic response to Alice's question, what does it mean, puts meaning itself into abeyance. I don't have this on the slide. She says, what do you mean? What does it mean? It's a scratch mark that means something to Vaudsells, obviously. I couldn't tell you what it means. Ethnological difference causes a fissure in the very notion of a single community based on having a language, and weakens the force of this notion to distinguish the human from the animal. Beyond this, Faber is also making a bleakly ironic point about language and the cultural construction of morality in the reader's world. Because she's arrived from another planet, Isserly's ethical vocabulary is far from being in any sense given. Rather, it's been shaped by a sociocultural education, principally reading, she finds books in charity shops and things, and watching television, in which the very concept of mercy is itself missing. But of course, we Vaudsells watch the same things. We Vaudsells arrive in the world in need of a moral education too, and we watch the same things that she watches. Thus, we might say that cultural texts are haunted by a difficulty of accommodating otherness as such. And indeed, the novel suggests that this is a constitutive failure, which readers implicitly tolerate. For if it's impossible for the sense of the word mercy to be translated into Isserly's language, or indeed into the debased language of compassionate illiterate Vaudsells, how much more difficult must it be to translate into English Isserly's quasi-understanding of this concept in her own tongue? Remember, she speaks a different language from English. Not to mention to capture the gap between that quasi-understanding and a full understanding of it as that gap grows in her conversation with Amlis, someone who speaks her own language. And yet, all of this is marvellously achieved, but simultaneously obscured as we readers consume the text's narration of her consciousness in English, not the language that she speaks. This all goes to show that the relation between the linguistic communication of suffering and any feeling of pity or compassion offered in response is not at all straightforward, and the narration of these feelings is even less so. Such self-attacking fictional form thoroughly undermines the concept of human possession of language that is so crucial to Isserly's exceptionalist understanding of species hierarchy. Under the Skin's literary qualities of species are, in this moment, radically anti-anthropocentric. It's in this context that we find Isserly mentally rehearsing ideas that might stave off the threat of dissolution and the idea of Vaudsell language, that the idea of Vaudsell language poses to her sense of species hierarchy. She considers the idea of performing the word mercy for Amlis, quote, as if she were being asked to reproduce a chicken's cackle or a cow's moo, but rejects the idea because, quote, to speak the word at all dignified it with the status of being a word in the first place. At a stroke, she would be dignifying the Vaudsells in his eyes with both writing and speech. At this point, Isserly has a putative ethical epiphany about her own dissimulation. which the novel highlights with a sudden leap from indirect to direct reporting of her thoughts. But isn't it true, she asked herself, that they have that dignity? There's the possibility here of the text affirming the fundamental moral significance of language capacity, a humanism which would absolve the whole issue of using animals as livestock from ethical questioning in the novel, and defeat the point of me writing about it. However, the irony is that her scheme shows up perfectly that language simply does not have the positive or dignity-defining content that Isserly imagines that it does. Writing and speech, indeed all forms of utterance, always remain susceptible to being divorced from meaning in the context of reproduction, mimicry, or performance. Crucially, moreover, this fate affects a cow's moo or a hen's cackle, which we should remember have a meaning, as Francois showed us yesterday, have a meaning in the feedlot or in the battery farm that Isserly is trying to remove by performing, by using it as a signifier in this context. Right? So those words, animals' utterances, just as much as humans' utterances, don't have that firm, meaningful content. Just like the word mercy here. The real challenge for an ethics of feeling here, then, is to accept that if there's no word, mercy or otherwise, that has the force to command a compassionate response, there's no expression of animal suffering that has that force either. It's a really scary thing for a pro-animal person like me to say. It doesn't have the force to make you respond compassionately. Amos offers one way to respond to this challenge. When confronted with Isserly's self-interested insistence that the word mercy is meaningless, and with it her implicit measure of non-human indignity, he observes quietly that he can guess what it means. But she replies scathingly, I'm sure you wouldn't let a little thing like ignorance stop you. In this willingness to give himself up to a guess about the meaning of mercy, Amos displays a certain weakness, or perhaps more positively put, a judicious openness in reading animal subjectivity that explicitly runs counter to the priorities of verifiable knowledge. Such is the risk implicit in the sympathetic imagination. In Isserly's eyes, however, such sympathy is nothing but debased sentiment that contravenes the facts of ontological difference between humans and animals that license her duplicitous reasoning throughout the chapter. As such, it's easily attacked as the ill-formed excesses of compassion. This is my favourite quotation from the novel. The thing about Vodsels was, this is Isserly, people who knew nothing whatsoever about them were apt to misunderstand them terribly. There was always the tendency to anthropomorphise. In the end, though, Vodsels couldn't do any of the things that really defined a human being. They couldn't sjubel. They couldn't mesnishtil. They had no concept of slang. In their Britishness, they'd never evolved to use hunshur. Their communities were so rudimentary that hissisins did not exist. Nor did these creatures seem to have any need for chael, or even chaelsin. As nowhere else in the novel, it doesn't really feel very sci-fi. There's not lots of weird language like this. There's one paragraph like this. Nowhere else. Faber here saturates the prose with the classical science fiction effect of invented vocabulary, and the effect is to denaturalize the idea of language as species-defining technicity. We never find out what these alien properties are, lending them an air of the arbitrary, but their apparent structural equivalence to concepts like language and tool use, shame, clothing, cultural transmission, and altruism parodies the anthropological use of such concepts. These alien words become instead the bearers of a purified human exceptionalist logic in which concepts, being able to, evolving to, having the concept of, being socially complex enough to, rather than offering specific ethological truth claims, are fetishized and made to carry the weight of species definition. Amos's attitude could not be further from this. The meaning of the word mercy for him lies beyond language as capacity, as a sign of pain, suffering, and grief that and need that we can never fully understand but must guess at in a moral response. Ethical interpretation at this moment is a form of accepting cognitive vulnerability, ambivalence and not knowing. We've travelled some distance from the idea that moral recognition requires the revelation of a fundamental truth about community across species. Isserly, on the contrary, resists any prospect of community with fossils by relying on the political logic of species to remind herself of various undignified truths about them, their brute bulk, disgusting stink, and uncleanliness, all recognisable, of course, as speciesist notions projected onto animals. Had she been so badly butchered, she thinks at one point, brought so close to an animal state physically that she was losing her hold on humanity and actually identifying with animals? Isserly rejects Amelsey's attempts to sway her towards a merciful cross-species egalitarianism that recognises such pain as shared across species, something that might compel her to alleviate it. Doing so, she suppresses the threat it poses to her identity and status by way of her bluntest and yet most desperate expression of species exceptionalism. "I don't know what you expect of me," Isserly burst out suddenly near tears. "I'm a human being, not a vodzel." Amelis looked at her up and down, as if only now noticing her horrific disfigurements. He stood there in all his beauty, his black pelt glistening in the humid air, and stared at Isserly, and then at the vodzels and the marks in the dirt. "I'm sorry," he said at last. Unlike Amelis, who is privileged both socially and in terms of his human physical appearance, Isserly needs anthropocentrism. Just as elsewhere in the novel, she relies on her special status as a worker, as a basic grounding of self-respect that counters her subjection by the elite. By sacrificing respect for vodzel animals, she secures respect for herself. In this context, the egalitarian generalising, implicit in Amelsey's appeal to a kind of creaturely sameness under the skin, motivated by compassion as it is, not only lacks the ability to combat such differences in power, it reinforces them. Isserly's feelings of what you might call species panic in response to his cross-species sympathies are thus quite understandable in circumstances. So much is accepted by Amelsey's eventual apology. By this point, however, the purportedly objective definition of species, biological, ethological, anthropological, or otherwise, has been thoroughly suffused with subjective feeling. It's not an objective statement of fact at all. It's a kind of, it's motivated by her feelings. To underscore this fact, Faber relies on the ambiguous use of "as if" in the quotation there, in the narration, quietly to denote that the feelings of horror about disfigurement on show here are not Amelis's acknowledgement of the abject status of Isserly's animalised body, which would precisely confirm a species-inflected class hierarchy with him at the top. Rather, they betray the self-abnegation implicit in Isserly's essentialist fantasies of a pure species identity, which she has projected onto Amelis. That is, they're played out dialogically in an interpersonal encounter with him in which she perceives herself as abject by imagining his attitude to her. The logic of species exceptionalism offers Isserly the best way to repress this unbearable feeling of her own abjectness. Even as the fabric of the novel shows her faith in it to be groundless. Amelis's politics of species, however much it is based on his own willingness to make himself vulnerable to pity and sympathy with the vodzels, simply reinforces the dynamic of power that drives Isserly's species exceptionalist repression of the fundamental subjection that she shares with the vodzels. On her planet, she gets stuck in the down underground. On this planet, they get stuck underground. It's happening to both of them. As Stephen Broom notes, erasing the lines drawn by repression is one of several key features of the literary Gothic, which, quote, "invite the repressed to return. They bring us on stage with pain, and force us to see what fascinates us at the same time that it disgusts us. The us, in the case of Under the Skin, might well eventually be meat-eating humans in a world dependent on animal slaughter, but in the first instance, it's Isobe. For immediately after her discussion with Amelis, is perhaps the novel's most awful return of the repressed. She's subjected to a vicious sexual assault by one of the hitchhikers that she picks up, a Vodzo whose portrayal, fat, barely intelligent, filthily dishevelled and totally bald, makes clear that he's the uncannily powerful doppelganger of the abjectly weak monthling that Isolde hopes to turn him into. For Isolde, up until this point, it's not simply that Vodzos are passive or weak victims rather than empowered agents. Instead, their utter unrecognisability as social subjects, which we have seen is predicated in the logic of species, obviates the very question of their power. The violence to which Isolde is subject at the hands of this hitchhiker in the second half of the chapter thus recapitulates in horrific form Amelis' moral challenge to Isolde's ignorance of the Vodzels in the first half, a challenge which mainly takes the enlightened romantic form of an impassioned but logical appeal to egalitarian community. He's like a kind of Tom Paine figure, really. Importantly, this is not to say that the text teaches Isolde a lesson by usurping her power, and what a misogynist lesson it would be. There's no narrative pleasure of this sort on offer, although the text cannot but draw energy from the fetishization of violence against women that is a staple of Gothic horror. The point is rather that Isolde's way of conceiving power is itself somehow shaken by the horrific experience of a Vodzo as brutal rather than as brute matter. The logic of speciesism had allowed her to repress the frightening truth that such vulnerability is ever present in life by displacing it from her subjectivity to be replaced by her capacities as a skilled worker and as a human, displaced from them and onto Vodzos. They, in turn, safely contain the threat of living vulnerability because Isolde's speciesism ensures that they are not recognised as subjects of experience per se. The assault is also crucial in the ethical development of the narrative because it returns Isolde to the original dehumanising trauma of her surgery, which means she no longer has the human physical capacity to fight the Vodzel off or to escape. While also replaying the section in the holding pens, this time with Isolde as the object of violence, At a critical moment, she, just like the Vodzo, has an ineffective reliance on the linguistic sign to plead for mercy. And again, language is shown to lack the power to effect an ethical response. Desperately, she searched for the right word, the word that might make him stop. It was a word she knew, but had only ever seen written. She'd never heard it spoken. Murky, she pleaded. The narrative very stagily orchestrates the dramatic irony here. In an effect, more or less conventional in Gothic horror, in which narrative and ethical pleasure should come from the reversal of fortune as the human-eating baddie gets a dose of her own plea for mercy ignoring medicine. However, because Faber has by this point in the novel done so much to develop readers' empathy with Isolde, the effect utterly misfires, and the conventionality of genre falls away to reveal an awkward moral ambivalence. Such is the utter murkiness of mercy. Faber draws attention to the mistake of presenting ethical attachment, responsibility, and action in the revelatory form of making things clear. As we saw with the Vodzo, Isolde's language capacity is shown to be relative by her lack of capability to use it to plead effectively for mercy. As such, she cannot escape from this situation by way of a vulnerable appeal to an ethics of pity. Speak to the powerful, ask them to be good to you. Indeed, the Vodzo completely ignores pleas for freedom that she makes on several grounds. Instead, she escapes through a tactical manipulation of the rapist's objectifying visual desire, violently turning it back on itself. Leaning on the car, she invites the assailant to look at scar tissue from the removal of her tail, his violent desire redirected towards the mark of violence. As he struggles to see, she uses this leverage to pivot around and gouge out his eyes from inside his clammy skull. Here, the novel's ethics are expressed in a gothic mode, with morality externalised through violent punishment rather than internalised through reasoning. As the story proceeds, Isserly's characteristic affectless demeanour increasingly slips as she loses both the commitment to her work that offers individuation and self-definition, and the commitment to species exceptionalism that stood as the moral justification of that work. Increasingly troubled by eruptions of feeling she cannot understand, she finally tries to control them by experiencing the violence embedded in meat-making practices in the form of a sort of dark, sadomasochistic self-definition. Amelis's attempt to save her by casting a new moral light could, theoretically at least, have been a response to the kind of claustrophobic fear of darkness, downwardness, and internality that conditions her life on Earth. Rejecting that, and filled with self-loathing, she obsessively seeks to witness the slaughter in the hope, it seems, of re-signifying the dark space of Vodzo manufacture as a place of kind of nihilistic ecstasy in which her pure power is confirmed in a violent display of the Vodzo's pure weakness. Ironically enough, however, this emotional or psychic investment is found by the men who work in the slaughterhouse to be too close for comfort to a form of embodied feeling like empathy or sympathy. A character called Unser, who is he's called the chief processor in the slaughterhouse, banishes Isserly from the abattoir precisely for failing to take her own erstwhile dispassionate attitude. "We are doing a job here," he says. "Feelings don't enter into it." This glimpse that the pure horror of the meat process is its very instrumental normality she had previously relied upon results in a major psychic collapse, in many ways the key crisis that compels Isserly's eventual rejection of Vess Industries and its speciesist practices at the end of the novel. Just got a couple of concluding paragraphs and I'm done. Isserly thus moves away from a reforming ethics of feeling that drives compassionate moral action by revealing vulnerability and suffering. The fundamental murkiness of mercy, its ambivalent combination of agency and passivity, and the necessary lack of political or ethical assurance on the basis of what properties would demand mercy, means that it cannot simply be the effect of improved moral vision. The book instead works through Isserly's strategic manipulation of the victim position in order to exert a self-protecting force. At the critical moment, Isserly cannot rely on the responsibility of the other, just as Amelis's egalitarian compassion also recapitulated the violence done against her by his father's company. Instead, she draws from the violence exerted on her as a source of strength. The book thus suggests that an ethic of responsible feeling is nothing if not backed up with some kind of power. The point is not that Isserly learns to see the Vodzels as moral subjects. Isserly is not Amelis. She doesn't have this kind of morality. Rather, a violent encounter with one of them profoundly troubles her by replaying the foundational objectification that her speciesism had staved off. This is a crucial stage in her rejection of violence, but to return to Berlant's terms, its importance is that the two separate sections of the chapter function not as an education in compassion, but more basically as disruptions of Isserly's coldness, her affectless and instrumentalizing perceptions of life on Earth. She comes to reject the self-destroying violence of anthropocentric humanism, in which she objectified both Vodzels as the inhuman, as brute matter, and herself as pure labor force, to escape the primary violence that prefaced her life on Earth. These are precisely the stakes in the bargain with structural inequality that Berlant highlights in that quotation as the political reality of compassion in modernity. Only we can now see that at the most fundamental level, this bargain is struck with an unequal economy of species difference, and its currency is animals' dead bodies. And yet, Under the Skin also recognises that violence is perpetuated by both the sacrificial prejudice of species exceptionalism and the egalitarian fantasy of enlightened compassion, which looks at the next in line ethical object of concern, not at the foundational violence structuring political life as such. This pessimistic position reinforces the need for a murky ethics, better placed to acknowledge and recognise two linked things: the repression, that is the unseen effect of this primary violence, and the vulnerability, rather than the liberating power, that subtends both mortal being and a merciful politics of feeling. Thanks.